This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota. At the same time we're broadcasting, we're streaming at prairiepublic.org, and then the show's always available after we broadcast at the same place, prairiepublic.org. We're called Main Street. And today we start our show with Samuel Sprinsenatic. He's a Bismarck filmmaker. He calls himself a storyteller as well, and he focuses on documentaries. And we're going to talk about his newest piece of work, Kindred Creatures, a full-length documentary. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Doug.
Well, give us the synopsis of Kindred Creatures.
Sure. So Kindred Creatures is basically, it's my first feature-length documentary. It's about 70 minutes long, and it's all about the ways of life and the personalities of animals used in animal agriculture. So chickens, pigs, cows, goats, and sheep. It kind of dives into their personalities, the bonds they can share with humans and other animals, and just kind of, yeah, we follow stories of these animals' rescue, and we also go on to farm animal sanctuaries all across the Midwest and kind of see what they're doing and why they're doing it and why it's so important.
Why did you pick this subject?
Sure. Well, probably like 3.5 years ago I started making this documentary, and back then I had I kind of started to go vegetarian, just realizing I wanted to get away from meat. And at that time, I didn't have a huge reason why other than I knew I loved animals. And I wanted to learn more about, like, if I do this, why should I, you know, why was I doing this? And so I reached out to a chicken rescue in Minneapolis. And this was maybe like I've been vegetarian for about 5 years, four and a half years ago. And just to go out there and kind of see what they're doing with these chickens and really get to know if they have personalities and, you know, this life that we may not have. Because as a documentary filmmaker, I like to research and I like to kind of dive into things that I don't know a whole lot about. And so that's where this started. And so I went out there and I was originally going to shoot just a mini documentary about a chicken rescue, just so that myself included, we could all learn about it and why they do what they do. And so I went out there and shot this documentary and had like about a 10-minute edit, and that's what it originally was going to be, just a small little film. And I stupidly did not back up my footage, and I dropped my hard drive, and I lost everything.
Oh.
Yeah, and I was kind of devastated, and so I felt defeated for a little while, but then someone a little wiser than myself said that sometimes you have to let certain things fall apart so that you can make way for bigger, better things. And I was like, wow. You know what? You're right. Let's do this again. Let's try this again, but let's do it bigger. Let me like reach out to some other sanctuaries who aren't just chickens and see what, you know, what cows have to say, see what pigs have to say. And that's kind of where this film started.
You know, when I started watching the film, I was struck by, and this struck me as a little oddball, like chicken sanctuaries and one that was specifically just for roosters.
Sure.
So it sucked me in, though. I have to say that it became very intriguing, and I should tell our listeners that it begins, frankly, with a fellow by the name of Tom Regan. He's an animal rights philosopher who mm-hmm. passed away a few years ago, but
yeah.
He's pretty well known on this subject. So why did you pick him? And I know the family helped support you with this project.
Totally, yeah. Well, it was during the shooting of Kindred Creatures, in the first year, one of the sanctuaries – it was actually Chicken Run Rescue. They know all about Tom Regan and love his work, and he inspired them. And so during that interview, they talked about that. And when I was going through the edit, I kind of found that very interesting. Oh, who is this Tom Regan? Let me see if this is something I can use. And I went back and looked at his work and looked at his speeches, and he was so well-versed and professional with what he was saying, and I thought it gave the film this, I don't know, just a whole another level where it seemed, I said, a little more professional and philosophical, and I think that was something that I needed. And so I reached out to his family to see if there was a way that I could use some of his work since he's passed away, and they said yes. And so I started the film with him, and then I have a whole nother section of him and his work that intersperses through a whole towards the end. It just kind of runs throughout the film.
Well, it begins with a case for animal rights presented to the Royal Institute of Great Britain in 1989. So this isn't a new idea.
No. He's been talking about this for years and years and years. And those videos that I have of him from, you know, the late 80s, he was doing animal rights philosophy years and years before that. So he's been doing this for a long time. He was almost the front runner of it, I would say. And so, yeah, a lot of people still don't quite know of his influence and his impact. And once I realized that and had a connection with it, I decided to try to show this to another group of people nowadays.
Well, I was really struck by this series of animal sanctuaries that you showed us during the course of the documentary. Yeah. And I'm thinking the whole time I'm watching this, these animal sanctuaries are surrounded by commercial operations, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's the industry in mm-hmm. parts of Minnesota and much of North Dakota. So what is an animal sanctuary? How does it work?
Yeah, well, a farm animal sanctuary is a place where farm animals are rescued and rehabilitated. And so, I mean, they can come anywhere from, you know, cruelty and neglect. They can come anywhere from the pig was running down the middle of a city block. They could come from, you know, animal agriculture where they're about to go to slaughter and they get saved. And so there's a ton of different ways that these animals end up where they are. But the same thing is that they all are in need of help and they all are in need of love. And they all need a second chance. And so these sanctuaries give that to them. And they give it to them in a way that they stay at the sanctuary for life. This is their home. And they get to be themselves. They get to be free. They get to have friends and run and play and eat good foods and basically just live the way that our dogs and cats live and live the way that we live, free.
Domesticated farm animals.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The incident with Wally the hog is one that's really intriguing because there's a picture of him jumping out of the back of a semi at 70 miles an hour. So obviously Wally thought that would be a better idea than staying in the back of the truck.
Yeah, yeah, he definitely did. And pigs are so smart. That's one of the things I've learned throughout this process is how they're smarter than dogs. They're smarter than like 3-year-old kids. And Wally, I mean, having met him now, it's just insane how smart he is. But he definitely knew what was happening and he definitely knew that he needed to get out of there because he was in the back of this truck and it was caged in. And somehow he found a way to lift one of the flaps and it lifted up and he jumped out at 80 miles an hour and the flap shut after him. And so all the other pigs, none of them got to escape. But he was 2 miles away from the slaughterhouse. So if he wouldn't have jumped then, he probably wouldn't be here. And we're about to go on to his it's Wally's third jumpiversary, which means it's 3 years since he jumped off that truck. He's had 3 more extra years of life. And now, I mean, when he jumped off the truck, he was about like 6 to 9 months old. And pigs can live to around 20 years old. So he's still got a long life ahead of him.
Well, let's talk a bit about this animal sentience idea because, of course, everybody who owns a dog and lots of cat owners will say the same thing, that they can kind of communicate with the animal. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, there are words they respond to, even music.
Yeah.
So what did you discover about what animals know or don't know?
Well, I basically discovered that a lot of people, myself included, because I ate meat for, like 28 years of my life. That these animals, they're somebody's and not something. And so for me, they're always just a product. And once I started figuring out this deeper level to them, I mean, it just made me realize something that I didn't know my whole life. I mean, I never thought about it. It never crossed my mind. And so it kind of just changed my view of other animals. Because I'd always loved dogs and cats. I mean, I have 4 cats of my own right now. And so loving these animals and, you know, every day they're like my kids. And once I found out that these other animals, pigs and chickens and cows, those sanctuaries look at them like their kids. They look at them like their dogs and their pets. They, you know, pigs, there's a pig named Brock and he sits for treats. There's a cow named Scruffy and his owner Buck, when he first met Scruffy, he was a meat eater then, and once he met Scruffy and formed this bond with him and had this amazing friendship, they became like best friends, he decided he can't eat them anymore. And so it's kind of life-changing when you realize how beautiful they actually are.
Sam Sprinsonatic is a Bismarck filmmaker, and we're talking about his newest piece of work, Kindred Creatures, a documentary about the rights of animals, I guess is one way to put it. Mm-hmm. These animals that you've seen that are rescued, they're raised, I assume, as vegan animals.
Oh, you mean like the sanctuaries?
Yeah, I mean, do kindred creatures eat other creatures?
Oh, well, a lot of these animals are actually herbivores. And so pigs and cows and chickens, they eat, you know, they eat hay and they eat berries and they eat vegetables and they eat fruits. And as far as I know, none of them eat other animals.
Well, we've been told over the years that there have been circumstances, sometimes disease-producing circumstances, with animals that have been fed for market, pigs yeah. and hogs and beef in some occasions, with other animal parts.
Yeah, and when you go to these sanctuaries, I mean, they don't – and I don't know all these other agriculture places and what they give the animals, but on the sanctuaries, I know – that they don't give them other animals to eat. They give them fruits and vegetables. They give them healthy stuff so that they can keep thriving. They don't give them antibiotics, which is what some places do. They really some of these industries want to fatten these animals up as much as they can, as fast as they can, to produce as much profit as they can in the least amount of time. And so the sanctuaries are kind of the opposite. They don't think of them as a product that needs to get bigger and better and grow and grow and grow and will, you know. And so they don't give them all these extra hormones and these antibiotics and these things that aren't healthy for humans to eat either. And so these sanctuaries really try to give these animals the healthiest, best life that they can.
Well, some of the sanctuary operators are a little idiosyncratic, for at least to me. I was thinking of the woman who makes sweaters for chickens.
Yeah. yeah.
And they kind of roam around the house, not typically how people raise chickens, or yeah. have chickens, I should say, since
yeah.
she's not raising them for some other purpose. Now, you live in Bismarck, mm-hmm. and that part of the state is livestock country.
Yeah.
And it's a very important industry in North Dakota. Mm-hmm. Do you think you're tilting at windmills? I mean, what kind of a reception do you expect for kindred creatures in your hometown?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm kind of expecting a little bit both ways here, people to love and support it. And also people that are probably going to be not that excited about it. And I understand that. That's like any art, any piece of film. There are people that like it and hate it. And I just know that there's a lot of people around the country that this film is for, like animal rights activists and vegans and animal sanctuaries. And I know that they're going to love it and promote it. But in North Dakota here, I mean, we'll just see it. It might open people's eyes, or it might make people uncomfortable. And I'm not quite sure yet. But I tried to make this film mostly just about like the personalities and happy things of these animals, as opposed to a lot of cruel things, because there are a lot of documentaries that have that, and I tried to steer a lot more away from that and focus just on these beautiful sides of them. I do have one small like 2-minute section that showcases a little bit of it, because it was needed. It feels like I couldn't tell this story without talking a little about that. It felt like I was trying to avoid it. I actually had a cut of the film that had a lot more of that stuff, and then I had a cut of the film that had none of that, and none of them really worked. And so I just showed a tiny bit at the end, but the most of it is positive, happy animals and stories of them.
Well, the video of the chicks being processed is memorable.
Oh, yeah.
How do the people who operate animal sanctuaries feel about the idea of owning animals, because they have to protect them?
Well, I think they're all – they like it. It's hard for them, because I know that they get – every day they have people contacting them to help animals, and they can't help them all, because the more animals they have, the more money they have to put towards these animals. And so it's hard for them, because they can't save all of them. But I know that the ones that they can save, they're just in love with their – they become their kids. And it's really inspired myself and my partner Medora to want to live in the country and help animals as well. And so that's kind of our goal.
Well, I did remember the sanctuary operator in Wisconsin, a woman who said that she had to say no so often. So
yeah.
That keeps coming up. Did you observe any similarities among the people who operate these sanctuaries? Do they have some sort of thing in common besides wanting to protect animals?
I mean, they all just had a lot of compassion. And that's the thing that when you meet them and when you see them, when you talk to them, there's just a level of compassion that kind of goes beyond what I've felt a whole lot more in my life about these animals. And so they all have their separate personalities, and some of these sanctuary owners are quirky and some of them are less quirky, but they're all compassionate people who just want to help the earth, and they want to help animals, and they really just want to help. Kara from Soul Space, she's the one in Wisconsin who you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
She actually, right across the street from her, they have a facility that processes cows and slaughters cows and raises them for their meat. And so she has this right across the street from her, but it doesn't bother her because she knows that she's doing what she needs to do. They're doing what they need to do. Everybody's on their own path. And those two are kind of – I know they're kind of friends, you know. They don't have a hate for each other and they don't have a competition. I think that everybody realizes that they're all saying their own truth and kind of going after what they believe in.
Well, the impression I get is that these animal sanctuaries exist because these people feel very strongly about obviously doing what they do. But if you project past – if their ideal world existed, these animals would be living out there free and unencumbered and not worrying about us preying on them.
Yeah.
But if we follow that argument, there'd probably be – fewer of them because we compete for space and resources.
Yeah. What some people are saying is that if we do that, if we don't eat the animals, if we let them be, that there's going to be a huge amount of them throughout the world and they're going to be overpowering. And what are they going to do? They're going to just be living out on the streets. They're going to be living. And what people have to realize is that if we do not eat the animals, it's supply and demand. And so over the course of time, less animals will be raised for the purpose of meat, and so less and less of them will be bred into existence for this. And once, if the world ever does become that way, there's going to be so few of them being bred into existence that the ones that are still out here, they're going to be living on farm animal sanctuaries. And so there wouldn't be a huge overpopulation of animals running the world.
Well, they might become sacred cows like they are in India too, you know,
yeah.
Where they just roam everywhere
yeah.
and people just, give them room.
Yeah.
You, of course, touch on the business of raising animals for consumption, and
mm-hmm.
You also must be thinking about the development of alternatives to animal protein and,
yeah.
Popular foods like hamburgers. We've got the Impossible Whopper out there, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's you're really seeing a whole lot more of plant-based products these days, and so people are starting to kind of realize and catch up and kind of change a little bit, which is exciting for me. And exciting for these animals. Joaquin Phoenix in his Oscar speech talked about the rights of animals. And like you said, the Burger King and KFC and all these places are having plant-based products now that are becoming super popular and sometimes almost more popular than their other counterparts. And so I think that it's slowly growing. It's definitely not at the way yet where it's going to become the absolute norm, but it's definitely growing.
What's the most significant thing you learned, Sam Sprincenatic, while creating this documentary?
The most significant thing that I learned was just about compassion, trying to find that compassion within myself and realizing the inspiration that these sanctuaries are having on the rest of the world. It's a growing movement, farm animal sanctuaries, and it's growing like every year. And so it's really just shown me that there's a whole nother side to compassion. It showed me that there's a whole nother side to these animals and basically a whole nother side to what I knew growing up and how I was raised. It's something that I think is not talked about and not shown to us. And it's almost, taken away from us that this thing even exists. And so I just learned a lot about the deep connection of these animals, but also about that there's a lot of things in this world that I might need to look into a little more to get the actual facts about.
Well, this film, Kindred Creatures, was supported by a GoFundMe effort.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned it took, 3.5 years or so, but you also had a bit of a health scare there a couple
yeah.
of years ago.
Yeah.
So that probably extended the time spent on it. But now it's available online at iTunes, right?
Yeah. It's available on iTunes right now to buy or rent. And it just came out on Monday. So as of right now, I'm not doing any screenings except we're going to be doing some in the Minnesota, Minneapolis area. But for right now, it's just on iTunes.
And you can find out more about these options to animal protein at chooseveg.com, chooseveg.com.
Yep. That's a great resource. And, I mean, if you look up on Google vegan anything, I mean, you can find recipes, you can find information, you can find a recipe for just about anything on Google. And so, yeah, there's a lot of ways that you can research online and find out a little bit more about this and if it's something that you do or don't want to consider.
Sam Sprincenatic, the filmmaker behind Kindred Creatures. Thanks for joining us, Sam.
Thank you so much, Doug. I mean, it means a lot to me.
Coming up on Main Street, the safety of private water wells.
Take a look at why Venice is flooding so often.
It's not that Venice is sinking so much, it's that the waters are rising.
Find ghosts of World War II in Papua New Guinea.
So you are walking through history, but it's as it looked in 1942.
And celebrate Carnival like they do in Basque Country.
Many people, they go in to see Carnival, but you have to leave it.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Federal regulations require public drinking water to be regularly tested for a long list of potential contaminants. But as Brian Grimmett reports for Harvest Public Media, owners of private wells test or don't test what they want. And some experts say water, often tainted by fertilizer, could be unnecessarily risking health.
New research from Kansas State University shows the quality of groundwater in the Great Bend Aquifer in south central Kansas is a lot worse today than it was 30 years ago. The main culprit is nitrate, which comes from the fertilizer farmers use on their fields.
The change that we see is comparable to the most extreme change measured by a nationwide study. So this is a pretty big increase in nitrate.
That's Matthew Kirk. He's an associate professor of geology at Kansas State University. High levels of nitrogen in water can lead to serious health issues such as shortness of breath. It can even cause death in young children and older adults. In his research, 7 of the 22 monitoring wells Kirk tested exceeded the federal limit for nitrates in drinking water. But the federal limit only applies to public drinking water, what you drink if you get your water from a city. There are no federal or state regulations protecting the water quality of private wells. There aren't even any rules that private drinking wells be tested at all.
I think one of the big takeaways, one of the important things that I hope people get out of this is that they should have their water tested.
Brian Snelton is the president-elect of the National Groundwater Association. He says it recommends private well owners do a basic quality test for bacteria and nitrates once a year. But testing your well is a lot like other home improvement tasks.
Some people tend to overlook it. It's one of those things that you can forget about. It's like changing your car oil or getting a yearly service on your HVAC system.
While a basic test is going to be fine in most cases, there are other chemicals some people need to worry about.
You want ice in it, or you just want it cold?
No ice.
Before contamination forced Randy Williams to connect to city water a few years ago, she always assumed the water she drank from her private well was clean.
The lady that sold us the house had us taste the water and hold it up to the light. She was like, see, it looks good. And then we had it tested on our own. And since it tested fine, no problems.
But it wasn't fine. A toxic plume of cancer-causing dry cleaning chemicals had tainted the well. It had likely been there for years. The chemical is odorless and tasteless, and basic water tests for bacteria wouldn't show that anything is wrong. Williams wishes she would have been more informed about the potential dangers near her well, such as dry cleaners and underground gas storage tanks.
Had we known, we probably would have done more testing, because of course we want to be healthy.
Meridian Labs in Wichita is one of a few places that offer comprehensive residential water testing. Jessica Jensen, the lab's technical director, says she often has to walk people through the results of the more complex tests.
Some people just need that peace of mind. I'm not giving them any extra information that we haven't already provided for them, but sometimes people just need to walk through.
Elizabeth Ablaw researches population health at the University of Kansas School of Medicine in Wichita. She says that knowledge gap is a big part of the problem. Without some kind of standardized statewide regulations, she says it's too much to expect regular people to fully grasp complex water quality issues.
If we are solely relying on, quote-unquote, educating the public about how to use their wells and which tests they need to be able to run, and the expectation is just too grand.
She and a colleague worked with state agencies and other stakeholders to develop 18 recommendations for improving and protecting well water quality. But that was a year ago, and so far, nothing has changed.
Really, there's no entity that is currently focusing on water quality for non-public water well users, and that is a problem.
She worries that without some kind of change, the roughly 150,000 Kansans with private water wells will have to continue relying largely on luck to know if what they're drinking is safe. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Brian Grimmett.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaborative that looks at America's farm and rural issues. Coming up on Main Street, a naturopathic doctor talks about seasonal affective disorder. And we'll hear another selection from Patrick Hicks. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. The Democrats have a candidate for state auditor, Patrick Hart, a small business owner and contractor from Pembina, made the announcement today in Bismarck. Hart had previously worked as an auditor for both the North Dakota Public Service Commission and State Agriculture Department.
When I look at this Office of the State Auditor, just really am drawn to that because I think that should really be a fairness and a kind of an integrity-driven position, and I'm really excited to bring what I can to that office.
The incumbent auditor, Republican Josh Gallion, also worked as an auditor for the PSC. Hart says he wants to make sure the audits themselves are not political in nature.
When I was performing audits for the Department of Ag and the Public Service Commission, it didn't matter where my politics were or the licensee's politics or my boss's politics. Right was right and wrong was out of compliance. So that's really what I want to bring to the office.
Gallion has announced he will be seeking a second term. Farmers must make decisions about crop insurance over the next few weeks, and a new tool from the University of Illinois can help. Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin has more.
The crop insurance calculator allows farmers to enter their state, county, crop, and other farm information, and it spits out different premiums. Gary Schnitke is a professor at the U of I and helped develop the calculator. He says crop insurance is important, especially in these uncertain times.
Crop insurance provides a backstop when you're not getting the yield because of some sort of drought or wet weather. So it provides protection to the farmer.
Schnitke says the calculator is based on a spreadsheet his team has kept for years. He also says premiums this year are generally lower than last year. The crop insurance decision deadline for farmers is March 15th. Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
The crop insurance calculator is available online at farmdoc, F-A-R-M-D-O-C, .illinois.edu, farmdoc.illinois.edu. And the number of hunting, angling, and boating citations were down slightly in North Dakota last year. Game wardens across the state issued more than 2,300 citations during 2019. That compares to over 2,400 in 2018 and 2,500 2 years ago. Outreach biologist Jim Job says the department doesn't get to keep the fines and penalties imposed by the court system.
The citations that we write, they all go to like the school system, the school fund. We're out there with sportsmen's dollars, though, enforcing these laws. So all this is all the money that it takes to enforce the laws. That's all coming from license sales.
The top citation in 2019 was failure to carry a license. That was followed closely by hunting and fishing without a proper license. For Prairie Public, I'm Todd McDonald.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Seasonal affective disorder, often shortened to SAD, is a common type of depression that comes and goes with the seasons, typically starting in the late fall and early winter with less daylight and going away during the spring and summer. Naturopathic Dr. Ali Swabany visits with our Ashley Thornburg about SAD.
Dr. Swabany, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What is seasonal affective disorder?
Seasonal affective disorder is a type of depression that comes and goes with the seasons. Typically, it starts in late fall or early winter and then goes away in spring and summer. That is a typical cycle of seasonal affective disorder, but there are also cases of summer depression, less common.
So how is it that we can have a depression that can change with the seasons?
So just terminology-wise, the reason it's called seasonal affective disorder versus depression is that it comes and goes with the seasons. Depression does tend to be more chronic, but it's under that blanket umbrella, probably because we don't exactly have a classification for it in any other way.
Okay.
It comes and goes because a lot of things change in our environment and in our bodies from season to season. And so that is the underlying reason why we notice this more some times of year than others.
Okay. Is it just a lack of sunlight?
That's certainly a piece of it. There's a lot of theories or hypotheses, I guess, that they're working on to try to truly understand seasonal affective disorder. And most of them focus on changes in the brain, the neurotransmitters, that the chemicals in your brain, essentially, your hormones, your circadian rhythms, or your sleep and wake cycles. So these things, of course, are correlated with the light and dark in your part of the world mm-hmm. at different times of year. And there might also be some genetic implications and some other psychological factors, but the primary thing we've found consistently is that sunlight has a lot to do with it.
So those of us in the northern climates might be more prone
susceptible.
To this?
Yep.
Okay. What are the rates, though, at, you know, for this area anyway?
So I know the statistic in our country, but I don't know for sure necessarily about our area, but there's a wide variance in the levels, again, that it's reported. So again, people have this but don't call it that or don't recognize it as that. Mm. But from anywhere from 3 to 10 million cases each year are reported
okay.
of seasonal affective disorder. And it is more prevalent in women.
What would be some of the key indicators that we should be looking for? I mean, yeah, it's easy to say I'm more tired. There's
right.
more than that.
Right. So we all probably get a little tired here and there throughout the year, but particularly in the winter. But those feelings of hopelessness and sadness, of course, thoughts of suicide are going to be signs of depression. Oversleeping, sleeping too much, not being able to sleep, concentration difficulties, severe drops in energy levels and fatigue, irritability, and sort of that isolation can be a piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
So just to note that if you are somebody who may get seasonal affective disorder in the summer months, I'm just going to tack on that that does tend to present as more of an anxiety, lack of sleep, weight loss, poor appetite.
Almost sounds more like a mania.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Would someone who is more prone to seasonal affective disorder in the winter be also prone to it in the summer and just have a change in how it's expressed, or do you kind of only get one or the other?
Generally, it'd be one or the other, because if you have both, then we're moving into other types of, like, other categories of mental illness, because you'd be having then those symptoms throughout the year.
All the time.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Okay. So what can we do?
One of the things that I think of as I go through the list of symptoms of seasonal affective disorder is, you know, you can look at that and think, is there anybody who lives in our region who doesn't have seasonal affective disorder, right? Like, there's weight gain, there's drops in energy, there's feeling of wanting to cozy up and be at home, basically hibernate. So I don't mean to downplay the severity of it or the importance of it, but I also want to talk about another way to frame seasonal affective disorder that maybe isn't talked about as much in the mainstream, which is just considering our human natural cycling, just as nature does, just as the animals do. You talked about the bear hibernating. We are intimately connected to nature, or we should be. We have been since the beginning of time, and more we are less connected, so we somehow think it's weird that we want to slow down in the winter, even though everything outside is covered in a blanket of snow, at least in our region, and is clearly slowed down.
Right.
So
but
it's
for
only,
humans, it's laziness.
Right. So there's, I do want to just point out that there is a very interesting expectation of us on ourselves to be the same way throughout the year. Mm-hmm. Culturally, that's really driven home with the productivity of our jobs and our lives. And so I think, you know, it doesn't mean we don't need to do anything about it if we're in a place of constant sleepiness or fatigue and weight gain and feeling sad. Obviously, there are still measures to care for ourselves. But I do think that it's interesting to think about that natural cycle being a part of why we kind of take a dip in the winter.
Sure. But that dip, left unattended, can get to be very difficult. It could possibly threaten your mental health, your livelihood. And then, of course, we are in a modern society, so you do have to go to work.
Right.
So let's say you can't sleep in every day until 11 and become a, you know, a mini hibernating bear. Are there some things that we can do at home besides, like, you know, go to a tanning bed or something?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to start with movement again. I use the term movement to mean any type of movement that makes you feel good. A lot of people say exercise, but there are people who have aversions to that word. So I'm going to say movement, right? So even in terms of thinking seasonally, you can choose to move in ways that work for the season you're in, right? So we might not be in the mood to go out for a run in the winter months, but maybe some yoga or maybe some dance or maybe something on cross-country skis or snowshoeing, finding ways to move your body that fits with the season. So I think of that as a preventative measure. Okay. And it's a big one. It makes a big difference in people's lives, and the consistency is really important. So you don't have to work out at the gym for 2 hours a day to feel the benefits of this. You can move for 15 minutes and feel it.
Okay. Sometimes it's hard to get even there, you know, if you're waking up and you're having really sad thoughts and your mind goes to a place where it's actively working against you and even your ability to want to take measures into your own hands. So even if you're at the point where you don't want to get up and move, is there something before that?
Yes. First and foremost, see a physician if you're in that place.
Okay.
If you're having a lot of difficulty getting out of bed and having any motivation to move about your days, it's time to see a doctor.
Okay.
But I would also say that vitamins, nutrients can play a big role. So that can come from food, but also supplementation. So we've talked about vitamin D before, and that's something that can really impact people's winter wellness. They can feel much better taking vitamin D throughout the winter. Vitamin D3 is the form you want to take, and generally taking, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 IUs of vitamin D throughout the winter months is going to be pretty beneficial for most people. Sometimes I give people higher doses, but I also test vitamin D levels in the blood to make sure I know how much they need. So if you're questioning how much to take, you can find a doctor who tests vitamin D and get a recommendation there.
If you're doing a big amount like that, do you want to go from, you know, 0 to 60, or do you want to be going, you know, first you're going 10 miles an hour, 15, 30, you know, and then building up? Like, do you need to increment in?
With vitamin D, you really don't. It's a fat soluble vitamin. So, you know, as long as you don't have major kidney issues, you can take a fairly large dose and your body will use it over the course of the week. So people who forget to take their vitamins, I will often have them take one dose a week, a large dose.
Oh, wow.
And that is generally pretty effective for most people.
So that is the pill form of something that we are getting from the sun. When it's nice enough to not be covering up your skin and going outside. But they also sell these, like, light boxes. Sometimes they're called sad lights for seasonal affective disorder. Sometimes the branding is different, and they're called happy lights. And the idea is that you're supposed to sit in front of them, and they what?
They give you light. So they help your body produce vitamin D, essentially. And so the idea is you have a light box, you put it on your desk or your table at about arm's length away and turn it on. You've got to have your eyes open because part of the absorption comes through your eyes. And that treatment, if done consistently, can really help the vitamin D production in your body and help you maintain better energy and mood throughout the winter.
So if you are doing that, should you not be taking the vitamins then?
So the truth is that every person I've tested vitamin D on who hasn't been supplementing has been low. So, I mean, low by my standards. So I don't think generally there's a problem with doing both. Okay. Again, if you have questions, consult a naturopathic doctor or somebody who's well-versed in the use of vitamins for health and wellness. But doing, you know, 2,000 IUs of vitamin D a day and also using a light box generally is not going to be a problem for most people.
Does that come in food?
Very little. We do get a little bit from food, and I can't even tell you the sources right now because it doesn't tend to be a sustainable way for us to maintain our vitamin D levels in our body. And in some of the northern climates are the highest rates of some diseases associated with low vitamin D levels. So we're talking about seasonal affective disorder right now, but things like multiple sclerosis are linked to low vitamin D levels. And so those rates of those diseases tend to be higher in our northern climates. So there is some evidence coming forth for keeping vitamin D levels up.
If you have seasonal affective disorder and you basically leave it untreated, is it possible that there will be an even more serious condition later in your life?
Yes. Certainly it could lead into a more chronic depression. And depending on the underlying causes of the seasonal affective disorder, like we talked about, vitamin D could lead to other chronic diseases in the future. The biggest risk that I can see would be depression and anxiety being something that lingers into the spring and summer and then becomes a chronic ongoing illness.
Hmm. Remember when doctors used to prescribe moving?
Did they do that?
Yeah, there was a lot of move to the sea or move to the sun.
Oh, yes.
You know, it predated some of the science behind it. They didn't always know the reasoning for it.
But I have had patients request I put that on their treatment plans to convince their partners they need to move.
Well, good luck with that. We'll see how the insurance companies take that up. Dr. Swabny, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ashley.
That was our Ashley Thornburg in a conversation with Dr. Ali Swabany, who practices with Prairie Naturopathic Doctors in Moorhead. Next on Main Street, poetry from Studio 47.
Hi, I'm Barb Gravel, host of the television show Prairie Musicians on Prairie Public, Oakland.
Break out these chains, let's burn it down.
Anchorage. New Orleans.
Rice, crispy treats and noodles. Home alone, Macaulay Culkin. Cause sometimes, I need more space than stars can give me. More sky than God provides me.
Columbus, Georgia. What do these places have in common? They're some of the hometowns of NPR's Tiny Desk Contest winners. The 2020 edition is on, and we'd love to see someone from North Dakota, Eastern Montana, or Northwest Minnesota win it all this year. So Prairie musicians over 18, sound check, and then film yourself performing an original song in front of the Tiny Desk of your choice. Then upload it onto YouTube and do a little dance for luck, because it'll be judged by a distinguished panel that includes multiple Grammy winner Brittany Howard of the Alabama Shakes. The winner will perform at the iconic Tiny Desk in D.C., and embark on a 10-city U.S. concert tour with NPR Music. Entries must be in by March 30th. Just go to npr.org/tinydeskcontest for complete rules and to upload your clip.
Are you ready?
We're so thrilled to welcome the winner of the Tiny Desk Contest!
The 2020 NPR Tiny Desk Contest. Go for it, Prairie musicians!
Thank you for joining us for Main Street on Prairie Public. Poetry from Studio 47 comes to us from Patrick Hicks. Patrick is writer-in-residence and a member of the English faculty at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. Today, he profiles poet Maria Mazzioti Gillen.
She was born on March 12, 1940, in Paterson, New Jersey, a town that she still calls home. She grew up in a working-class Italian-American family, and much of her poetry is about being the child of an immigrant, of growing up with olive skin, and being part of a bilingual family. Mazzioti Gillen graduated from Seton Hall University and then attended New York University, where she received an M.A. in literature. She wrote poems from a young age and, Growing up in Patterson, she was aware of the rich poetic history that came before her. Patterson, after all, was the hometown of William Carlos Williams and Allen Ginsberg, two giants of American poetry. Mazzioti Gillen's work is known for its conversational tone, its raw honesty, and for how she elevates the everyday. She is the founder and executive director of the Poetry Center at Passaic County Community College, which is famed for its public readings. She is also the director of the Creative Writing Program at Binghamton University, SUNY. She has written and edited over 20 books, including Italian Women in Black Dresses, All That Lies Between Us, Ancestor's Song, Identity Lessons, Growing Up Ethnic in America, and Writing Poetry to Save Your Life, How to Find the Courage to Tell Your Stories. She has won the Barnes & Noble Writers for Writers Award, the American Literary Translators Association Award, and the American Book Award. She has read her work all across the United States, as well as in France, Finland, Ireland, and, perhaps not surprisingly, Italy. Today's poem is What I Can't Face About Someone I Love. The popular image of a poet is usually that, I suppose, of someone who doesn't think much about real life, or of someone that isn't grounded, or of someone that has their head in the clouds. The poems that tend to impact readers, however, are almost always full of great emotional bravery. Today's poem is like that. It's full of the everyday, and it's full of honesty. This is What I Can't Face About Someone I Love by Maria Mazzioti Gillen. That my son loves me but would prefer not to see me too much. Every Sunday night, when I call him in North Carolina, where he lives with his wife and two children, I can hear the heaviness in his voice, his hello, tempered with impatience, our conversations stiff and stilted, though I always think I can talk to a stone. Strangers in buses and trains tell me their life histories. Acquaintances tell me about their affairs and shattered marriages, show me the secret undersides of their lives. My graduate students vie for my attention. They want to sit next to me and carry my bags and fetch my lunch. But my son can't wait to get off the phone with me. I ask him how the kids are, or specific questions about school, ask about his wife, his job. He answers with one or two words, they're fine, or okay, or the same. My son is a lawyer. He was always brilliant with language, at least written language, and he can read a 300-page book in an hour and remember every detail. But with me, he turns mute as a stump. If I ask for help with some legal problem, he will give it, but I do not hear in his voice the lilt I hear in my daughter's voice when I call her. Instead, I hear reluctance, as though his attention were focused on some truly fascinating person and he can't wait to get off the phone. I tell stories that I hope will amuse him, but finally, after struggling and finding no response, I can't wait to hang up. I say, "Well, John, have a good week. Give everyone a hug for me." I know my son has divorced me, somewhere deep inside himself, in a place he doesn't look at. I am too much for him, too loud, too dramatic, too frantic, too emotional. I laugh too much. I wear him out in a minute and a half. If he never saw me again, he wouldn't miss me, and this is what I can't face about someone I love.
Patrick Hicks reading What I Can't Face About Someone I Love from poet Maria Mazzioti Gillen. Poetry from Studio 47 is recorded at Augustana University and is produced by Peter Folliard. Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
The Minot Chamber Chorale is performing their yearly Winter Classical Masterpiece Concerts on Sunday, March 1st at 3 p.m. in the Annicole Nelson Hall on the campus of Minot State University. This year's concert features the Norwegian composer Kim Andre Arneson's Magnificat, featuring visiting artist Tess Altaveros, and accompanied by strings, organ, and piano. The concert is free and open to the public. A free will offering will be accepted to help support programming. More information is available at MinotChamberChorale.org or on the Minot Chamber Chorale's Facebook page.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 19th. February is Black History Month, and in North Dakota, the African-American population has grown, though historically the numbers were few. But there have been African-Americans in the state as long as there have been white people. Early records indicate that the earliest came as slaves of explorers and traders. In fact, the first non-native born here was an African-American baby. Aside from slaves, others came of their own accord to follow the American dream. One of our most famous North Dakotans was Arabelle Thompson, who became the international editor of Ebony Magazine. She was the daughter of a homesteader near Driscoll, who then moved to Bismarck in 1919 to run a second-hand store. Ironically, blacks had a major advantage over the Scandinavians and the Germans. They spoke English. Some were associated with the steamboat trade from St. Louis, but many came as soldiers. They had fought in the Civil War, serving in regiments that later came out west to provide protection for railroads, homesteaders, and gold seekers. In July 1891, two companies of African Americans from the 25th Infantry Regiment arrived at Fort Buford on the Upper Missouri, quickly followed by a third. The next summer, two companies from the 10th Cavalry joined them, and by 1893, Fort Buford was made up entirely of black enlisted men. The only whites at the fort were commissioned officers. Native Americans called these buffalo soldiers because their hair reminded them of curly buffalo hair. And there were also African Americans working as cowboys. 22-year-old James Williams worked cattle in the Medora era in 1886, and it's told that he was such a good roper that he once lassoed a goose right out of midair. Another well-known black cowboy was John Tyler, a friend to Teddy Roosevelt. Of those who came to Homestead, William Montgomery is noted for his 1,000-acre bonanza farm south of Fargo. In the Mouse River area, Frank Taylor was a highly respected horse dealer. He had a ranch near Towner, where he specialized in raising and training Percherons and Belgians. And in sports, North Dakota had integrated baseball teams in the 1930s, long before Jackie Robinson broke into the majors. Baseball teams all across North Dakota lured some of the best players in the world from the Negro Leagues, including legendary pitcher Satchel Paige. In short, African Americans may not have settled here in large numbers, but their contributions have certainly been noteworthy. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Lots of companies in the U.S. collect and sell your data.
If you and I are partners and we're both wearing a Fitbit, that Fitbit knows everything about our lives. Everything.
But a new law in California is giving consumers the power to stop it. Could an attempt to strengthen that law make things better or worse for people's privacy? Plus, we'll recap the latest Democratic debate on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, we'll talk with Dr. Jerry Hatfield, former director of the National Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment in Ames, Iowa. He'll be a featured speaker at the Farming for the Bottom Line conference next week at Bismarck State College. Sue Balcom will join us for Main Street Eats tomorrow, and we'll look at our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.